Good morning. It looks as though we are all assembled. The court is sitting six on this matter, so you'll notice only six justices that you can see. Since we have four attorneys arguing, I'd like to go over the timing that I've been given to be sure that it's what you all agreed upon. So if I read this off and I'm incorrect, please correct me so we all start on the same page. Attorney Fassbender, you're going to begin with 10 minutes. Then Attorney McLeod will have 15 minutes. Attorney Cinderbrand will have 15 minutes. And Attorney Johnson Karp will have 15 minutes. Then we return for a 5-minute rebuttal for Attorney Fassbender. Is that what you all think is the drill for today? Okay, very good. Before I call the case, we're going to do a little demonstration about how the court keeps track of time when we're having oral argument by Zoom. So if you look in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, when it's time to start, I will tell you to go, but you'll also see a green start sign. When you have 5 minutes remaining in that portion of your argument, you will have a yellow sign that says 5 minutes. And when it's time to stop, you will see a red sign that says stop. I will hold you to the stop sign and help you to be reminded of it, that it's time to conclude, unless you are in the process of answering a question that a justice has posed when the red sign comes up. If that occurs, you finish answering the question, so you don't need to stop. But when you have finished it, I probably will rein you in, and then we will move on to the next participant. So with those brief reminders in place, I'll call our second case of the day, Clean Wisconsin versus DNR. And Attorney Fassbender, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes.
Please do.
May it please the court. I'm Robert Fassbender, counsel for Interveners, Co-Appellants, Business Associations. These are manufacturing and agricultural associations that have been involved in this case since the circuit court. Our interests relate to both the water quality aspects of the case, but mostly about the delegation aspects of the case. The essence of this case, we believe, is how Act 21's explicit authority requirement affects the analysis of the Lake Beulah court in that decision some 10 years ago. Specifically, the explicit authority requirement relates to how a court evaluates very clear enabling legislation like our high capacity well permitting program and more general provisions in the statutes, the preamble provisions we discuss. The court in Lake Beulah reconciled them in a way that we think Act 21 requires a reassessment. And that was specified in paragraph 42 of the case. And I think it's worth repeating in full here. It states that the legislature can, and in other contexts does, mandate the DNR issue a permit when certain requirements are met. But the legislature has not done so for high capacity well permits. Finding no language expressly revoking or limiting DNR's authority and general duty to protect waters and manage waters of the states, we concluded DNR retains such authority and general duty to consider whether a proposed high capacity well may impact the waters of the state. I think it's fair to say that the concept there is if it's not clearly prohibited, it's allowed. From a statutory interpretation perspective, we find that that's problematic. But clearly, with respect to Act 21, it's inconsistent. It's DNR's authority has to be explicitly provided. And this sort of, if it's not prohibited, it's allowed, is inconsistent with that. Act 21 was aimed directly at this concept. And it did so in two ways. There's two provisions that are relevant to this analysis. One is 227.10 2M, which requires an agency No agency may implement or enforce a standard requirement or a threshold unless it is explicitly required or explicitly permitted. That comes into play in this situation with respect to these high capacity wells. And I don't think there's any dispute. The question is there explicit authority in these general provisions that the court found allowed for a different standard or a complementary standard for additional environmental review? What's probably more contentious than the application of that is 227.11 sub 2A 1 and 2. That provision relates to rulemaking authority, and it states that a statutory or non-statutory provision containing a statement or declaration of legislative intent, purpose, findings, or policy does not confer rulemaking authority on the agency or augment the agency's rulemaking authority beyond the rulemaking authority that is explicitly conferred on the agency by the legislature. What's important here is, and it sometimes is confused, I think, in some of the briefing, is rulemaking authority, for those of us who've been practicing regulatory law for some time, is akin to regulatory authority. If you don't have rulemaking authority, you don't have regulatory authority. And so regulatory programs set up the conditions and the general applications that apply for permits. It's rulemaking authority and then permit authority. It's not either or. So this particular provision is directly applicable. And
I want to make sure I'm understanding exactly what you're saying right now. You're saying that the rulemaking authority and regulatory making authority is synonymous?
Yes. It is defined differently, but we are aware of no permitting program, especially a permitting program like high capacity wells, that can be implemented without rulemaking authority. And rulemaking authority is provided for high capacity wells, and we have rules on how DNR is to assess their applications. You cannot decouple them like the Lake Beulah Court did and say that we're going to address this on a case-by-case basis through permits. That standard, and why it wasn't workable, was that you have to evolve rules of general application on how that's to be applied.
Are you asking us to go ahead? I thought you were done. Make your point, please.
I think I made my point.
Are you asking us to overrule Lake Beulah?
I think that whether it's being overruled or not, yes, in short, yes. But really, what we're looking at is a reassessment on how you determine delegations in the context of Act 21. There is Lake Beulah stands for many things. The one thing that we think the court needs to reassess and change is using general preamble provisions to augment specific comprehensive regulatory schemes set forth by the legislature.
Counsel, how do you, in the paragraph you read in paragraph 42 of Lake Beulah, the sentence after the one you read talks about how this reading in Lake Beulah doesn't just avoid potential conflicts between statutes, but it also is recognizing that the state has a delegation of public trust duties. That comes from the Constitution. So how do you reconcile your reading with our requirement that we abide by the Wisconsin Constitution's public trust doctrine?
The public trust doctrine is in the Constitution, but it resides in the legislature. It has to be delegated. And the court has in the past said that delegations of constitutional authority have to be even clearer. So the question isn't whether DNR has the jurisdiction on public trust. Clearly, those preamble provisions put the rose on DNR. But it says in those preambles, consistent with, I'm implying that, but it says consistent with the other provisions in the statutes. So that preamble provisions may have said gave DNR jurisdiction, but it did not provide explicit regulatory authority with respect to high capacity wells. There's just nothing in there that discusses high capacity wells.
Counsel, since we're talking about the public trust doctrine and who bears the duty, I've got a question for you, because in your briefing, you say that the only public trust issue in this case is whether the legislature, not DNR, has fulfilled its public trust duties. Is that actually an issue for this court in this case to determine whether or not the legislature has fulfilled its duties? Because I agree with you, it's clearly under the Constitution, it's not a duty assigned to the DNR specifically, it's a duty assigned to the state and to the legislature, which delegated it statutorily to the DNR.
Well, I think the way we address that issue in the brief is that, in our briefing, is that if you find, and we think that you should, and under Act 21 will find, that the only enabling statutes for high capacity wells is 281.34. That's the enabling statute. That's what the legislature said, how we're going to fulfill our duty with respect to high capacity wells. That is something that the court, if they felt that they were not fulfilling their constitutional duties, they would have to say, no, we don't think you quite are up. We think that 281.34 doesn't accomplish or fulfill your responsibilities. We think they obviously did. Public trust is about weighing interests. We all have interests. The farmers have an interest in the water. Riparian owners have an interest in the water. The legislature needs to weigh those interests and have done so in enabling legislation 281.34.
But isn't that a fact-bound determination that I don't see in this record that has been really teed up for us to make that determination, has it?
Well, I think it would be we did not adequately brief it, and I think that you're correct, is that there isn't sufficient information to conclude that the legislature isn't fulfilling its trust duties. Just, I think it's on its face obvious on the consideration and the continued amendments to that enabling statutes that they are trying their best to address these competing interests. Thank you.
Attorney McLeod, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Good morning again. May it please the court. Eric McLeod appears on behalf of the Wisconsin Legislature. I'd like to pick up on where Mr. Fassbender left off concerning the public trust doctrine. It's important to note that while Lake Beulah describes in general terms this delegation of public trust doctrine authority to DNR, that's not what the court did in that case or ultimately recognized in that case, because while it made those general statements, in Lake Beulah, the court specifically looked to determine whether the legislature had in fact limited what are general pronouncements of the DNR's authority. The point being that this court expressly recognized that the scope of the agency's authority, even if the public trust doctrine is implicated, is to be found in the enabling statute itself. The point is the delegation of public trust duties, if that's the proper way to characterize this, is not an all or nothing proposition. Meaning, as Mr. Fassbender pointed out, the public trust doctrine resides with the legislature. The legislature makes a determination as to what aspects of its authority it's going to delegate to a state agency to implement. But the legislature always retains the authority to amend the statute as circumstances arise. And Justice Bradley's question about the nature of any constitutional claim that's made in this case, one would have to challenge the statute as properly applied under Act 21 as unconstitutional, meaning it fails to satisfy the constitutional requirements in the public trust doctrine. And if it doesn't, it's unconstitutional. That claim has not been made in this case, and that's not before the court. I want to turn to, again, the question of what explicit authority means.
Before you move off of that, Attorney McLeod, I lost you at the place where you said the legislature is the only one responsible under the public trust doctrine. I've read the Constitution and I've read our case law. And where do you get that from? That somehow the legislature is the only one. And if they want to, if they don't specify and aren't specific about it in there, or however you define explicit to equal specific, that therefore it's all on the legislature. Can you address that question, please?
Well, perhaps certainly the public trust doctrine resides with the state, and the legislature executes the lawmaking function in the state. So in order to give any effect to the public trust doctrine in a meaningful way, there needs to be laws passed that fulfill the requirements of the public trust doctrine. State agencies, DNR included, do not have any constitutional existence. They cannot independently under the Constitution be authorized with constitutional powers. They can be delegated specific power by the legislature, and those powers, some of those powers, certainly in the context of Chapter 281, relate to the waters of the state. So they are designed to fulfill the legislature's or the state's obligations under the public trust doctrine. But those enabling statutes provide certain powers to the agency to take certain actions. That doesn't mean that the public trust doctrine has been delegated to the agency, or that the agency has any constitutional authority to take certain independent actions separate from what the legislature has authorized.
So, Mr. McLeod, you'd agree, wouldn't you, that the DNR needs to abide by the Wisconsin Constitution?
It needs to comply with the statutes that describe the scope of their authority. And if there is a constitutional challenge to the enabling statutes and the requirements that have been imposed on them, that may give rise to a constitutional challenge.
Does the DNR need to abide by the Wisconsin Constitution, though?
It does, but not independently from the statutes which govern the scope of its authority. And if the question, Your Honor, is there a potential conflict between the agency here, DNR, complying with what the legislature has told it has the authority to do, and whether by doing that it may violate the state constitution, that may be, in a given case, a conflict that's implicated. I don't think it's implicated in this case, or at least that claim has not been made, meaning that the statutes that authorize the agency's conduct in this case fail to comply with the requirements of the Constitution, and therefore the statutes enabling agency action are unconstitutional. So that issue is not implicated in this case. But in a general manner, Your Honor, sure, the DNR has to act in a constitutional manner, but it must do so by fulfilling the requirements that are stated in the statutes that provide for its very existence. So I want to turn to the statutes, because I think that's where this case certainly needs to be decided. And in Act 21, we have two separate provisions that have been discussed, 227.10 sub 2M and 227.11 2A1 and 2. And there has been an argument made that the latter statutory provision, which relates to rulemaking, is somehow irrelevant to the court's analysis. We disagree with that, but I think it's quite clear that the use of the term explicit in both sections means that the court needs to look at both sections in order to look for clues as to what the legislature meant about the meaning of that term. So while 227.11.2A1 and 2 say that rulemaking authority must be explicitly permitted in order for the agency to promulgate a rule, it says that it cannot promulgate a rule on the basis of statements of general authority, aspirational statements concerning the scope, broad scope of power of the agency. It has to be explicitly conferred authority. So we know in 227.11.2A1 and 2 that explicit means we need to find this specific source for the authority for the agency to be able to act. So when we use the term explicit in 227 sub 0.10 sub 2M, we presume the legislature meant for the term explicit to have the same meaning. That's Kalal and many other cases concerning statutory construction. The term explicit must be understood in context, and particularly where the term is used in two separate sections of the same act, we presume the legislature had the same meaning. So how does that affect the understanding of 227.10.2M, which is directly implicated in this case? Well, look at 227.11.2A.1 and 2. It uses the term explicit, but it also uses the term express to discuss or refer to expressly granted authority to engage in rulemaking. So by using both terms in that subsection, express and explicit, we presume the legislature meant that explicit must have some higher degree of specificity in order to find the authority that would give rise to rulemaking power in the agency. So those are important cues that we would look to determine, well, what did the legislature mean when it said, in order for an agency to enforce or implement a standard requirement or threshold, including as a condition in a permit, what did it mean by the term explicitly required or explicitly permitted? Well, at a minimum, there must be a standard requirement or a threshold that the agency can point to and say, there is a specific standard, a specific requirement, a specific threshold that we're going to enforce. You cannot expressly permit or expressly require the implementation of a standard if there isn't a standard. If we can't look to a provision in either the statutes or the rules and say, here's the standard that applies in this circumstance. And we also know that
Council, we get back to the question of how specific must explicit be. In the last argument, as a closing comments, it was suggested that at least you could have categories, and the word category was used. So that's not the same as an express, discrete, or specific requirement. It's a category that's more general. So how are we to determine in this case how to apply those words? Is it specific, discrete? Is it a little broader, as was advanced in the parting comments of counsel in the last case, categorical? Or is it an argument that's advanced by your opposing counsel found in sub 3 and 4 of the statutes of 220, whatever the threshold is to sub 3 and 4, you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So how broad is, you know, broad? And then when you look at a lot of cases, Environmental Decade, Lake Beulah, which talk about the public trust doctrine and the obligation to interpret the statutes vis-a-vis the public trust doctrine broadly to protect the navigable waters of this state or the waters of this state. How does that all fit in? You know?
Well, those are excellent questions, Your Honor. And I want to walk through the operative statute that applies to high capacity wells, because I think the statute itself provides great clarity to understanding what explicitly required or explicitly permitted means in Act 21. So we look at section 281.34. We're now in the wells statute. We're talking about the permits required for high capacity wells. And there, a high capacity well is a well with a capacity of more than 100,000 gallons per day. And as we've outlined in our briefs, there are categories of wells below that don't require any permits, mere notification to DNR sufficient? And within the high capacity well category, there are those which we've denominated as medium-sized wells, and then those that are large wells, and those are subject to 28135 sub 4, and that's a separate category, but I want to focus on 28134 and the circumstances in which environmental review is required for that category of wells. It says,
let me interject with a threshold question, and I'm glad that you segued to 281.34 because I have a question regarding 281.34 sub 5M, which reads, no person may challenge an approval or an application for approval of a high capacity well. Now I'm getting to the language that I'm focusing on, based on the lack of consideration of cumulative environmental impacts of that high capacity well. Here, the lower court didn't lack consideration of cumulative environmental impacts. In fact, it was an abundance of consideration of cumulative environmental impacts. So can you address that threshold question regarding the challenge that can be brought?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a separate issue that arises in this case that's related but different than the underlying question of whether or not there has been explicit authority permitted or required to impose environmental review on the wells at issue here. Let me walk through that statute real quickly to make the point about when the legislature has explicitly required something and when it hasn't. Because in 281.34 sub 4, the legislature has outlined three specific circumstances where environmental review is required. And the language says the department shall review an application for approval of these types of wells pursuant to environmental review. In the case where there's a groundwater protection area, there may be an impact on a spring, or water loss of more than 95%. The legislature has said, DNR, you shall impose the standard of environmental review on this well application under these circumstances. That's explicitly required. That is an example under 227.10.2M of where the legislature has explicitly required an agency to take some particular action. So if we're going to find explicit authority that is permissive, we would assume that we would find a related provision somewhere in the statutes that say the agency may apply, if I may finish, Your Honor.
You finished the answer, yeah, because you're just in the middle. Go ahead.
You would assume that there would be language that said the agency may apply environmental review under some other set of circumstances. But there is nothing in the operative statute here, the enabling statute, which explicitly permits the application of environmental review to this category of well. And that's dispositive of the answer in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Bradley, did you get an answer to your question? Because I thought you started out asking about 5M. And I don't think that's where we ended up.
I
think you addressed that. You addressed something else first. So
I'd be happy to answer that as well, Your Honor, if you would.
That's fine.
Okay. All right. Well, it looks like Justice Bradley is happy with where we are at the moment, so we'll leave it there for now. Okay. Attorney Cinderbrand, you are up next. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Carl Cinderbrand from the law firm of Axley Bernelson. I represent both petitioners, Clean Wisconsin, Inc. and the Pleasant Lake Management District. I am joined today off screen by my colleague from Clean Wisconsin, Evan Feinauer. This court has a proud legacy of consistently, unanimously affirming DNR's delegated regulatory authority and duty to protect the state's public trust water resources. These cases, quite frankly, are a major reason we Wisconsinites enjoy a bountiful landscape for fishing, hunting, boating, hiking, and a wide array of recreational, tourist, and other economic activities. Interveners asked this court to substantially erase that history based on a single word in a single subsection of a statute that is otherwise wholly unrelated to this case, a statute of general application, a statute that does not expressly apply to environmental management, certainly not to the state's constitutional public trust responsibility. Instead, they cobbled together an argument that this statute has sweeping effect by reference to a separate statute addressing rulemaking, and in the process violating multiple canons of statutory construction, including arguing that a general statute should govern over a specific statute, interpreting statutes to create a conflict rather than to harmonize, an interpretation that renders statutory language meaningless, reliance on statements that do not constitute legislative history, treating statutes with different language to have the same meaning, creating constitutional issues regarding the state's fulfillment of its public trust responsibilities. And as the legislature argued in Palm, the legislature will not be deemed to have altered a fundamental regulatory scheme in vague terms. Yet that is exactly what the legislature and WMC and company asked this court to do.
Counsel, may I stop you there and ask sort of a fundamental question, for me at least. Are you challenging the legislature's ability to kind of claw back some of the authority that it delegated to the DNR in this case, but also to all agencies? Because I understand Act 21 as the legislature reclaiming some of its legislative authority over what are creatures of the legislature. Could you respond to that, please?
Yes. First of all, Act 21, with the exception of this one subparagraph, 227.10.2M, relates entirely to rulemaking. Other than that one subsection, it has nothing to do with agency decision-making, which is what we have here. Secondly, I would say we need to look at the context in which the legislature has authority under the public trust doctrine. The public trust doctrine does not use the term legislature. It is a duty incumbent upon the state, which of course, as we know, has three branches. The legislature, by virtue of its lawmaking responsibility, is the one that implements the public trust doctrine through legislation, delegating that authority to the executive branch. The executive branch has the responsibility to administer. And as the court noted in two majority opinions in the SEIU case, there is a fundamental distinction between legislating and issuing rules on the one hand and administering those statutes and rules on the other hand.
Can I stop you here again? Because in the Hilton case, this court said the legislature has the primary authority to administer, which was an interesting choice of word, to administer the public trust for the protection of the public's rights and to effectuate the purposes of the trust. So it seems the court has recognized the constitutional obligation primarily resting with the legislature.
I find the term primary interesting also, because I look at that case and look at it as a temporal responsibility. That is, before the agencies can act, the legislature must delegate that authority. So can the legislature retrieve some of that authority? Of course it can, but then it raises the question of in whom has it vested public trust authority, if not DNR? The cases are quite clear that this court has always interpreted, at least since DNR has existed for the past almost 50 years, has always interpreted DNR's responsibilities to be complete and comprehensive under the public trust doctrine. So the legislature and the courts have also said the legislature cannot merely not assign these responsibilities. It is an active duty. It is one that the legislature cannot divest itself of by inaction. And that goes back to the Prewee case, which from the 1890s. So it is not at all a new concept. If the legislature has not delegated public trust authority to the DNR and has not delegated it to someone else in its stead, then we have a constitutional issue. From my perspective, we don't have a constitutional issue because our view of the statutes, as reflected in the case law, is that the legislature has delegated that comprehensive authority to DNR.
Right, but if under 227.10 sub 2M, they have reclaimed some of that delegated authority, taken it back from the DNR, then that doesn't mean that there's nobody responsible for the public trust doctrine duties. It's the legislature's responsibility. And so the claim then would be from your client's perspective, whether or not the legislature has fulfilled its constitutional obligations under that doctrine.
I agree with you, Justice Bradley, but I would say that is not, from our perspective, an issue in that case. And the interveners suggesting that raises a very troubling constitutional issue, which this court should not meet. So that's where I stand on that. Let me get to the question that so troubled the court in the companion case that was just previously heard. What does explicit mean? Explicit has a definition in the statute. And explicit basically means expressed. Those are two synonymous terms. There is nothing magical about the dictionary definition. The interveners would like you to add that onto that. I believe Mr. McLeod in the last argument said, well, it's a contextual meaning because this is what the legislature intended it to mean. Here he says it means it doesn't include general authority because in another statute, they use the language general authority. That in 227.11 sub 2 discussion of rulemaking does not use the same language as 227.2M. And from that, we can discern that if the legislature wanted to preclude an agency from acting on the basis of its broad or general authority, it could have said so, just as it did in 227.11. The fact that it didn't indicates that that the legislature did not want to impose those kinds of strictures on decision-making that it imposed on the quasi-legislative conduct of rulemaking. And that is very consistent with that shared governance, shared responsibility concept that was so much the focus of the SEIU case.
Mr. Cinderbrand, can I just,
yes,
before you end, also, let me just ask you to respond to Mr. Fassbender's comment at the beginning of the argument that rulemaking and regulatory making is really the same thing.
That is an unprecedented argument that is not found, to my knowledge, in any case, in any articles of renown, in any statutory language. There are many instances in which the legislature has delegated authority to the DNR that does not require rulemaking. And I can give you several examples. In Chapter 30, which is a public trust statute, it relates primarily to structures in navigable waters. There is the broad general statute 30.12 that requires DNR to consider a public interest test in deciding whether to allow a structure or the extent to which it would allow the structure in navigable waters. Now, there are plenty of regulations relating to what a structure is, how it is designed, where you can place it, but there is no statute that further elaborates on what really is the public trust doctrine test. Does it obstruct navigation? does it interfere with public rights in navigation? And that is because there is no requirement for such a rule. In the statute specifically relating to piers, which has the same test.
Uncle, I'd like to bring you back to statutes that relate to water because the time is short today.
Okay, I apologize.
It's very complicated. Okay, yes. Justice Anne Walsh Bradley brought up 281.345M, which is consideration of cumulative impacts. And that provision says that no person may challenge the approval or an application for approval of a high capacity well based on a lack of consideration of the cumulative environmental impacts of that high capacity well together with existing wells. Now, that's what the statute says. My question is a little different. Could the DNR consider the cumulative impact of these eight wells? Now, they're not existing wells, but they are the ones for which a permit is sought in this case.
Absolutely. There is nothing in that statute that prohibits or directs DNR not to consider cumulative impacts. And we believe, and DNR believes, that you cannot protect public trust resources under in this context unless you consider cumulative impacts. Now, in one set of cases, it's actually three cases because there were four wells, DNR did just that.
So you don't think that this statute, because it refers to existing wells, has any implication in this case?
I would say it is the fact that DNR considered cumulative impacts both with existing wells and with other factors means that this statute does not apply. We did not challenge the DNR permits approvals because they failed to consider cumulative impacts with existing wells. They did consider cumulative impacts. Our view is that based on that evidence, the answer's wrong. These should have been denied, or these should have been further considered, perhaps.
Okay, and so you can apply the statute correctly, but your answer to my first question is there's nothing in the statute that precludes the DNR from considering the cumulative impact of these eight wells because they're not existing wells.
That is true, but I would add to that, Chief Justice, that there is nothing that prohibits DNR from considering cumulative impacts with existing wells also.
And counsel, do you get that based on the words lack of consideration? The statute doesn't talk about consideration, but it talks about lack of consideration. Is that where you're getting that argument from?
Yes, Your Honor. If DNR had said, we refuse to consider any cumulative impacts of the proposed well with existing wells, then that is what this statute would apply to. Now, whether that is a constitutional statute in that context is another question that's not before the court, but that is what the statute would apply to. If I can just go back to this notion of existing versus, the issue of what implicit means. Explicit means, it really helps to look at its antonym, implicit. And implicit means, according to Merriam-Webster, capable of being understood but not expressed. Explicit and expression are the same thing here. And in Lake Beulah, the court, which was clearly cognizant of Act 21, said on more than one occasion in the decision that they find that DNR has explicit, though broad, authority to consider cumulative, to regulate high-capacity wells under the combination of 281.11, 281.12, 281.34, and 281.35. If I can just finish my thought, I see the stop sign. Madam Chief Justice. Yes. And for that reason, I would ask the court not to overrule Lake Beulah. You got it right. And decline the intervener's request to legislate from the bench to create more of Section 227.10.2M than it says. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Now we will hear from Attorney Johnson Karp for the DNR. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Chief Justice.
Please do.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. This case is and must be about the statutory text, about the text that this court interpreted in Lake Beulah in Chapter 281 to impose a mandate and a duty.
Counsel, we didn't ever interpret Chapter 21. I was on the
Chapter
court.
281.
It was not briefed for us because it was enacted after the briefs were filed. You will find it in footnote 31, which I've read and read and read, but I can tell you it was not briefed, nor was it argued to us in that case. So, you know, to me, they're like two ships passing in the night. I don't really have any problems with Lake Beulah, but I don't think they addressed it. I do think we need to address it.
Chief, if I said 227, I misspoke. I meant to refer to 281 that this court interpreted in Lake Beulah. Specifically, provisions in 281, 11, 12, and 34. Those provisions that this court did in fact interpret and did recognize to impose a duty and the authority on the department.
I understand that, but what the court didn't do in Lake Beulah that I think we have to do here is decide whether Act 21, as it would interact with the statutes we talked about there, would give a different effect, a different outcome. That's kind of where I see the case. Am I not in the right space here?
Well, I think the bottom line, Your Honor, is that statutory language must control. And here we have clear statutory language in Chapter 281. And I think we can jump right into the statutory language. We can start with 281.12 sub 1, which says the department shall do what is necessary to protect, maintain, and improve state waters. So this is a unquestionably explicit mandate and authorization that this court recognized in Lake Beulah that requires the department to assess in every instance whether state waters are protected. So from that explicit and broad authorization, we can then move to 281.34, which...
Before you do that, counsel, to do what is necessary is, as you say, quite broad. It's hard for me to see how that's an explicit command to assess the impact of wells, for example.
As this court recognized in the Wisconsin Association of State Prosecutors case cited in our brief, to command something is to permit it. So for a statute to say that the department shall do what's necessary is to command that the department do everything that is necessary under that statute. That statute, as it existed and was interpreted in Lake Beulah, hasn't changed. So the command and the authorization to do what is necessary is as it was in 2011.
But that's unlimited then. So are you saying then that the legislature's attempts to corral the broad grants of authority that it gave to agencies like the DNR in these statutes, that it failed in its attempt under 227.10 sub 2M to corral the agency's delegated authority?
Well, I think the corralling of any authority has to come first and foremost in the statute that speaks to the point at issue. I think we've gotten into this habit in this case of discussing sort of this gloss of 227 rather than starting with the statutes. The statutes here, the high capacity well statutes, are Chapter 281. What does the language in Chapter 281 do? What does it command? What does it authorize? So to say the department shall do what's necessary to protect, maintain, and improve the waters, is explicit, and it's not unlimited. It refers to necessary to protect and maintain the waters. This isn't authority to jump into another agency's lane and do things unrelated to waters. This is a specific authorization to do all that's necessary for state waters.
Is it your position then that the legislature, if it wanted to reclaim some of the authority it's delegated to agencies, would then have to amend each and every statute that gives any general or broad grant of authority to each and every agency in order to accomplish that?
That's right, Your Honor. To change the meaning of a statute, the legislature needs to change that statute rather than telling this court or the judiciary generally to disregard plain meaning and to now interpret shall do what's necessary in a way other than to mean shall do what's necessary.
But it sounds like you're asking us then to not give any effect to 227.10 sub 2M.
I'm saying that 10.2M doesn't do what the interveners propose. What they've been discussing in terms of this clawback of agency authority appears nowhere in the text of 10.2M. What 10.2M does is it refers to implementing or enforcing standards, requirements, or thresholds. So I think the question here, after we look at the authorization in Chapter 281, is are we talking about implementing or enforcing standards, requirements, or thresholds? And I think it's useful to contextualize what's at issue in this case and whether that is in fact implementing or enforcing a standard, requirement, or threshold. So this case started with a determination by DNR that there is no authority to even assess whether a proposed high capacity well would adversely impact state waters. That was based on the now intervener's view of Act 21 that it was a standard, requirement, or threshold being implemented or enforced. But when we look at how these applications come in, it's clear that that's not implementing or enforcing. So the well application comes in and it provides the DNR information about a well location, the proposed pumping capacity, distance to water resources. Is it close to a lake? Is it close to a stream? Some of the information in that well application will inform the mandatory analysis under 281.34 sub 4. So in some instances, what we see in an application is the sort of red flag of an EIS. In those sub 4 instances, the environmental analysis will be required. But the mandate for that environmental analysis in sub 4 doesn't speak to the vast majority of other wells. So if we're talking about an application that doesn't fit in one of the sub 4 categories, but is, for example, proposed to be located near a lake, near a stream, the intervener's view is that DNR has no authority to even take that next step of looking at what that impact would be. And so the question is this analysis that we just discussed, is that implementing or enforcing a standard, requirement, or threshold? And the answer is no. There's no implementation or enforcement on anyone. Implementing or enforcing is more along the nature of what the court and the parties were discussing in the previous case of when we're talking about conditions in licenses. That is implemented or enforced. But the assessment that was supposedly precluded here is not that. So 10.2M just has no bearing on what is at issue in this case. And then, of course, the next question is, well, accepting that the department, counter to the position taken below, accepting that the department has this authority, that it can look at the impacts that a proposed well might have on state waters, Can the department then act on that? Is that next step implementing or enforcing a standard requirement or threshold? And I think there are two answers. The first is that the statute 281.12 and then also 281.34 explicitly authorize the department to do what's necessary to protect state waters. And this comes from, as I discussed in 281.12 sub 1, that mandate to do what's necessary, but also in 281.34 sub 2, there is a baseline prohibition. So the statutes have created a baseline that no one may withdraw water without the department's approval. From that baseline, then, the department is then authorized to do what's necessary to ensure that proposal, that well, will not harm state waters. So we have this explicit authorization to take the information gathered from this application assessment and to work with the landowner. And what we see is that the department will then go back to the landowner and say, look, this well that you're proposing, let's use a number of, 200,000 gallons per day. The amount that you're proposing would impact state waters. On that standard, we would have to deny this approval. Landowner, farmer, would 175 work for you? Would something that serves the landowner's purpose be approvable? And so the department will then issue an approval based on what protects state waters, but also serves the landowner's needs.
So the legislature argues that your argument then would give the agency, as the legislature puts it, almost limitless authority that actually is greater than the legislatively laid out, statutorily laid out specific and the specific authority that would apply to the high capacity wells. Could you respond to that argument, please?
Your Honor, I think it's important to always come back to the enabling statute, 281.12. And that is the command that we're working in here, that the department shall do what's necessary.
Legislature didn't need to put all these specifics in with respect to, and I'm using, not the statutory language, but the more commonly understood vernacular of small wells, medium wells, large wells. They didn't need to draw those distinctions then, because under your argument, DNR can do whatever it deems necessary to protect the waters.
Well, as to the creation of more mandatory requirements, there are certainly instances where it might not be necessary, but the legislature has commanded that the department shall do this heightened assessment. So the categories in sub 4 are an example of the legislature saying, no matter what you conclude, DNR, in these categories, you must do this heightened environmental assessment. That's what that statute tells us about
the legislature. As part of that, how does subsection 5M fit in where when they're doing, DNR is doing its assessment, it can't consider the effect of existing wells with a proposed new well or new wells?
I think the effect of 5M is to recognize really what's at issue in this case. 5M, by saying that an approval can't be challenged based on the lack of consideration, shows that the department has that authority to do the cumulative impacts analysis, but that failure to do so itself cannot be the basis for a challenge.
So you say the statute doesn't have anything to do with the legislature's authority to do it, only a claim based on the fact that the DNR did not do it.
I think 5M is a claim limitation principle. It doesn't speak to the department's authority to do those assessments.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question. Thank you.
Good. recognizing that my time is short, I'd like to just touch on a few brief points. The first is this notion that 10-2M, or in that Act 21 generally, is a command to the judiciary about how to interpret all statutes. As we discussed a little earlier, I think it's important to note that interpreting Act 21 in this way would come perilously close to creating a problem of separation of powers. If the court were to accept the proposition that the legislature can tell the courts how to interpret statutes, I think we're getting into core interpretive powers of the judiciary. And the other point that I would note relates to the public trust doctrine. If I could just finish that, Your Honor.
Yes, just in a sentence. So
this court need not reach the public trust doctrine. The statutes that we've discussed today authorize and require the department to do the assessments that should have occurred here, but the public trust doctrine acts as a backstop that if there's any question about the interpretation of these statutes, they cannot be construed in a way that would harm public rights in navigable waters. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Attorney Fassbender, are you ready for a rebuttal? Your mic must not be on yet because I'm not hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can now. Okay, please begin.
This case is important, but it is not terribly complex. What the legislature did in Act 21 is pretty much akin to prior expectations of the regulatory community, that when we sit down with the legislature and other interested parties, we negotiate and work out regulatory schemes. That regulatory scheme for high capacity wells is set forth at 2D1.34. In Lake Beulah 2, a sister case to Lake Beulah that related to an ordinance preemption, the court recognized that that was a comprehensive permitting scheme and said that the ordinance, the local ordinance, was preempted. And it gave a lot of weight to the effort to develop these comprehensive regulatory schemes. And that's how we've been regulated, not with wildcard provisions in preambles, but through enabling legislation. Everybody agrees that agencies must operate within the boundaries of their enabling statutes. But enabling statutes is a concept that has evolved and has been broader. Act 21 essentially just says, no, it has to be explicit. If we're going to enable an agency to take over some of our lawmaking powers, it has to be clear. And the legislative history is supports that plain meaning that 281.34 is the explicit authority, is the enabling statute. There is only one high capacity well enabling statute. And then Act 21 also says you can't augment that specifically with the preamble provisions. If you have a regulatory scheme that's very clear, that's it. Don't start augmenting it. Now, that's consistent with prior interpretations of enabling statutes. I don't think it's all that complicated. It's just a sort of a resetting of expectations by the legislature to say, hey, listen, particularly constitutional delegations, this has to be clear.
Your friends on the other side, though, are arguing that you can't in one fell swoop with this statute in Chapter 227 claw back all the broad general grants of authority that the legislature made to the agencies. If you want to do that legislature, you've got to go into every statute for every agency and amend or repeal all of those grants of authority. Could you respond to that argument?
Again, it's going to come up in a case-by-case basis. It is an interpretive tool. In this case, 281 is pretty clear. Those preamble provisions are not explicit with respect to enabling DNR to regulate high capacity wells. There's no clawback of all these statutes that are just going to happen because of Act 21. But there is an expectation by the legislature that when agencies are enforcing their program, that they need to point to explicit authority. We don't know how often that occurs or not occurs. It's a case-by-case basis. We do know for high-capacity wells, there's only one enabling statute, and that's historically had been the case. Lake Beulah expanded that under implying that 281.11 was also authority to issue permit-by-permit decisions. Wasn't there before. It's not a clawback.
Do you think that 281.12 in its subsection 1 is relevant to our decision?
It's relevant in the broader sense of how the courts has looked at public trust delegations, but sub 1 basically says that DNR should have general supervision and control over the waters of the state. That's a jurisdictional designation. It doesn't say how they're going to exercise that. With respect to high-capacity wells, they were very clear on how they were going to do that. So it's basically, you got the rose pin on you, DNR, with respect to the waters of this state. And we will tell you how we're going to implement that with subsequent legislation. It's the way it was. It's just a jurisdictional statement, we believe.
Council, what parts of Lake Beulah do you think have to be overruled?
Paragraph 42, which states that if it's not expressly prohibited, then we can allow it. No, it has to be explicit.
What about its discussions in 39 and maybe 40 that really build on its earlier discussion of 281.11 and 281.12 that says in paragraph 39, we conclude that through chapter 281, the legislature has explicitly provided the DNR with the broad authority and a general duty, et cetera. Does that have to be overruled?
Well, if you look at section paragraph 42, and if you reevaluate the general versus the specific, you're going to have to conclude that the paragraph you just read doesn't apply anymore. Is that the specific with respect to high capacity well controls? I'm not sure I answered that question, but you can go through and redline the Lake Beulah decision. I'd love to be able to do that. But I think it's really that analysis of that unless you tell us we can't look there, we're going to look there. That's not consistent with Act 21. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for